Welcome to AUP Radio, a melting pot of voices and ideas. This evening we have Cryptic Delphic, Climate Conversation, and Taste of Home. Enjoy the show.
Hi, and welcome back to another episode of Cryptic Delphic with me, Mel, where we talk about horror, conspiracy theories, and just supernatural events that happen around the world. If you are new, welcome, and thanks for tuning in. And just a disclaimer, this show covers a lot of mature themes like cults, murder, a lot of graphic type of descriptions will be discussed, and just conspiracy theories. So if you're kind of getting uncomfortable listening to this, I don't recommend the show. But if you are a horror fan like me, then I suggest tuning in and listening. So let's get into something that I just saw on Twitter this morning, and it was kind of trending just for a little bit, and you can just like look this up. This is completely insane. So for those of you who are into like activism, Greta Thunberg is a very famous environmental activist at the moment. She is a teenager she works alongside Leonardo DiCaprio. She's been on the Ellen Show. She's been on so many different programs, and she discusses about the environment. She's a very inspirational person. They have this photo from 120 years ago that this photo was taken, and it's of these three kids who were at a place of mining, and the girl in the photo, it's a girl in the photo with a braid, and she has like a bandana on, and she's looking directly at the camera, looks exactly like Greta Thunberg. And all these different like conspiracies have speculated that she's a time traveler and she's here from the she's like from the past and she's here like to save us and to save all these like she's like been discussing about environment, so maybe she knows something that we don't know about. It's like kind of crazy if you really think about it. And she can go to any time period, so maybe she's been into the future as well. If she is a time traveler, like she's been to the future, she sees what happens and she's like, oh shoot, like we have to fix this, and she just goes back to our time and to try to help us prevent this from happening. Who knows, really? But it's a very funny and interesting thing to look at. I recommend that you guys go online and see this. Just type in like Greta Thunberg photo conspiracy. It's insane how alike that these two figures look. So I will now be discussing the Black Forest haunting. When I think of forests, personally, I love forests. I go hiking a lot and do like nature retreats. I love the trees, the smell, the wilderness. It's a very big thing in my family that we just go out to the forest and woods and just, we love nature. So northeast of Colorado Springs, there is this small town of Black Forest, which is within the nature. It's a very beautiful and serene city, but it has a very dark history to it. So back then in the 1800s, this place was a huge primary source of lumber and employed 1,700 lumberjacks. These people basically cut down trees and just kind of shipped them off and exported them to other areas that needed this for like cottage making or table making. It was a very big source of income. The Black Forest area gave 1 billion board feet of lumber to the Kansas Pacific, Denver, and the Rio Grande, and the New Orleans railroads as well. So they helped build the railroads there as well. So why is the Black Forest haunted? So the legend goes that the haunting began in 1991. Steve and Beth Lee got their dream home in the woods. They wanted some place to retreat and just be in the countryside, be far away from the city. So they found this house and they basically bought it, and it was their dream home, and it was perfect. But not long after buying the house, the couple began to experience strange occurrences, including unexplainable noises like chains, loud orchestra music, like smells that were coming from different places, flashing lights, and it really scared the couple, but they thought maybe it's someone that wants to just trespass. Maybe it's an intruder. Let us buy a security system to just try to figure out what's going on, and maybe we can see just who is behind these different actions. So the security system found nothing. It didn't really bring up anything, and it was a bunch of their disappointment because these things still continued happening. So they decided, let's just reach out to a TV show. Maybe it's something paranormal. So they reached out to a TV show, and that show is called Sightings. So I did some research on the show. It aired in the 90s, and it was really popular, running for 5 seasons. And it just focuses on paranormal activity. Paranormal investigators go to these different houses and places of interest, and they just kind of see if they can catch anything. So the show's producers, ghost hunters, and mediums determined that there were multiple spirits in the house, and there was a leader who was a male who kind of claimed the house as his own. And during the filming, one of the crew members and Beth were actually possessed by a spirit, and they caught that on video. Like, everything that happened was caught on camera. The crew member was quietly crying on the ground and saying that he felt a numb emotion all over his body, and Beth kept saying that she felt that someone was inside her, like within her soul. Spirit Seekers, a YouTuber, actually posted all the video clips, which are available to see to the public. If you decide to see this, once again, the YouTuber's name is Spirit Seekers, capital S on the spirit and capital S on Seeker. I watched it. It was a very, it's very intense video. If you are, this video isn't really for the faint of heart, and it can make viewers uncomfortable or scared or just feel like, you know, just not feel right. It can make you feel uncomfortable. So I really don't recommend to viewers who get really scared easily. But if you do want to watch it, I did mention the YouTuber, so you can go ahead and look him up. So after the show, the couple returned to the house 6 months later. They left the house and they decided to return and just, you know, maybe figure out maybe the spirits are gone. So they returned with a new sidekick, and that was a Hopi shaman. And he basically just kind of like looked around the house and consulted with them and claimed that the house had a rip in the space-time continuum. So now we're getting into like fourth dimension. He claims that the spirit can move freely between worlds, and that one of the spirits was named Howard, and he was the son of one of the Lee family friends that died years before. So other spirit investigators that visited the house claim Howard may have entered a rift time-space dimension and just trying to communicate with his father who is alive. So fourth dimension, there's like all these different ideas of there's our dimension, and then in a different world, it's very different. Like something else could be happening. Some spirits may be entering this other dimension thinking that they're alive, but, you know, they're actually dead and they're just trying to communicate with us, and they think they're alive, but, you know, we know that they're dead. We can't see them because they're in a different dimension. And it's just kind of like a very interesting thing to think about, whether or not you believe this or not. Because scientifically, there is, like, you know, like Einstein's thought of like physics and space-time continuum and how in space-time is relatively faster or slower. And it's just kind of very interesting to think about, and a possibility that could prove a ghost's existence. But it's a bit too complex to really, really believe that. So they, you know, there are videos on YouTube as well, which focus on like driving through Black Forest in the night, trying to catch some spirits in the forest, trying to catch some cryptic type thing. And it's very creepy overall, just driving in the woods at night. And something very interesting, I recommend that you also look these videos up, because it's just kind of interesting seeing the houses, how they're built, and just the area itself. And the forest is very beautiful. It's become a very popular hotspot for ghost hunters. So if you decide that you ever want to visit this little city in Colorado, go take a ghost camera and see if you can catch anything scary. So now I want to discuss about Hawaii's most famous murder, and that is the case of Lisa Ayu. She was just 19 years old. This is like super sad. She was just 19 when she was murdered, and she worked as a hairdresser in Kaluuya, Oahu. And on January 20, 1982, in the evening, she had just finished her shift, and her boyfriend called her saying that he was having dinner at his sister's apartment in Makiki. So she noticed that it was raining super hard. She wasn't sure if she wanted to drive to Makiki to see her boyfriend and his sister, but she decided, why not? Let's just go for the drive. I'll eat dinner, and then I'll go home. So she made it to the house, to the apartment, and she got with her boyfriend. Her boyfriend's name is Doug Holmes, and she ate, and around midnight, both her and her boyfriend got out of the apartment, said goodnight to each other, got into their respective cars, and just left, going back home. Doug made it home, but sadly, Lisa never made it home, and she was never seen again. So police assumed she was a missing person and that there was a possible kidnapping that just occurred. So they sent out an alert to the people to warn them that, you know, there was just a crime, and to keep their eyes out on any suspicious activity. And they did the most thorough and intensive search on the island in like criminal history for Hawaii. They looked in the swamps. Like, it was just a very intensive search. A ransom was demanded, and police started fearing that she was actually murdered, but they really didn't want to just scare the islanders and, you know, people, because, you know, it was just really intense, and nothing that intense and intense, like, just nothing that intense has ever happened. So January 31st, 1982, a jogger was out with his dog on Tantalus Drive in Makiki, and he came across a decomposed naked body. So when police arrived on the scene, they were quick to identify her, and sadly, they identified her as Lisa Ayu. So the state of her body, although she was just, they found her a few days later, and there was a lot of, like, already decomposition happening, they really couldn't determine how she died and when she died, which is very confusing. And I tried to do more research on that, but they just seriously didn't know when she died, even though the body was very, and it's sad to say this, but she had just died, and a few days later they found her. They still could have just found out at least how she died, but they didn't know. And it was just very suspicious, and the public was kind of confused on why they couldn't find out. So the police decided that she was murdered. They just guessed, like, she was murdered, so we have to find out who did this murder. So all these conspiracies began to emerge. One person said they saw Lisa driving at the night, and a police officer was following her. The person claims that Lisa was driving, and then a car had blue and red lights kind of, like, flickering behind her, trying to get her to pull over. So police were thinking maybe it's someone impersonating a cop. And when that news broke out to people, they were in a state of panic, thinking there's a person impersonating a cop that's pulling people over and making you, like, take out your license and registration. Because Lisa didn't have her license and registration in the car. That was missing. Her purse was missing. And the window was rolled down. So it was, like, as if she was talking to a police officer and, you know, like, giving her information to him, and then, you know, possibly getting murdered by that said person impersonating a police officer. They just created a state of panic. People were really worried. So that really made the police, like, it made the police get pressure on them, because they really needed to find this person, like, quickly. So later years, there would be some evidence uncovered by the AU family private investigator. They hired an investigator to see if they could figure out what happened. And the personal investigator believes that that story was made up to cover the suspect, and that the real suspect was still out there, but was being covered by the police. Later, there was another conspiracy that Lisa's boyfriend did it. Police reported that there were scratch marks on his face, and when they spoke with him 2 days after the murder, he failed 2 lie detector exams. There's a claim by a security guard at the apartment that Holmes and Ayu were arguing the night of her disappearance, but in the end, the police were really questioning him and putting him as a possible suspect. They really couldn't find any links and correlation to why he would commit the murders, and everything just kind of timed out. Like, his timing, he was there, he left, and then he wasn't near the area where her body was found. So they ruled him out as a suspect. They really just figured, like, he couldn't have done it. It was later found also that AU she forgot her driver license at the market, and that's why she didn't have it. So it couldn't have been she couldn't have given her license to a police officer. So the conspiracy theory of a police officer murdering her was dropped. But everything started getting weird with the police as the case continued. So witnesses claimed they saw a woman hunched over in a car with a man the night of her disappearance. But police never got back on that witness's claims, and they thought it wasn't really relevant to the case. And it is very strange, because normally when police officers get hear a witness say, or at least a possible witness saying, hey, I saw some really suspicious activity, there was a woman hunched over in a car and a man was driving and a woman was just murdered a few hours later, I think you should really check it out, that's very suspicious, what if this happens again, it's a different victim. But police just really didn't care. They just didn't really see it, like, oh, we don't need to check this out, we don't need to investigate. And that really weirded out the public and made them feel unsafe. So it turns out that this was actually happening a lot throughout the investigation. There was accusations happening, and then police quickly dropped those accusations. There was a mishandling of evidence as well, and missed opportunities to check out different sites, different locations. And the case was just kind of spiraling out of control. No one knew what was going on. The police was just very unprofessional. So it just really, they knew they were running out of time, but They just didn't really show that they cared. In 1983, investigators made a drastic step by exhuming her body to see if they could at least find out, like, how she died. So the condition of the body was found to be unwashed, covered in dirt and leaves, wrapped in a police body bag, and generally seemed to have been unceremoniously dumped into a hole in the ground. So that's very suspicious as well. Like, if you get a body, why won't you clean it up and immediately try to determine the cause of death? Why just leave it in a police body bag, dirty and just decomposing? Like, that is just very suspicious and honestly very unprofessional that the police did this. To make matters even worse, the skull and jawbone were examined by experts and they couldn't figure out the cause of death. But shortly after, the skull and jawbone just disappeared. Like, no one knows where the jawbone and the skull went. Like, no one knows what happened to them. And this other conspiracy just kind of emerged from this, of people thinking, oh, maybe they don't want the investigators and scientists to know what happened to the skull and jawbone, because that's going to lead to them finding out about how she actually died. Maybe the person that actually did it hit it, you know, and it was an insider, like a police officer or a investigator. So that just released another conspiracy theory, and the police tried to shut that one down rather quickly as well. So no one really knows what happened to Lisa Ayu. And a lot of questions are just popping up in my head. Like, why were the police so neglectful with her case? And like, why was Doug's face so scratched up the day after the murders and his girlfriend's disappearance? And like, why was her body so far from her car? And why was she naked? Like, there's all these different things that just went through my head while reading about this case. And it's just so sad that we're not going to know like the answers. Hopefully someday this case will be resolved and we'll know these answers, because this is just completely like horrendous. The case is discussed on KHON2 News. It's a Hawaiian news broadcasting site and can be found on their YouTube channel as well and their website. But please be respectful when you're doing your own research on this case. What happened was just very tragic, and we should be respectful towards Lisa Ayu, her boyfriend, the police that were involved in this case as well. Even though they were neglectful, we should not be disrespectful, and we should be respectful to Lisa's family and the private investigator that was involved. So now I'm going to talk about Japanese horror that is based on true events. Japanese horror movies are one of my favorite movies. I grew up watching a lot of Japanese like anime, Japanese horror, and I just really love like all the different urban legends that revolve around Japanese culture. You know, there's Japan's yurei and yokai, and those are basically like yokai are demons and yurei are like the spirits that are in like Japanese culture, and you know, it's just very interesting to read about. And some of these urban legends that Japan has are based on actual true life events that happened, and they're very interesting, and I want to like discuss about a few of them. So there's this about a doll, and we've all seen like those stories about dolls coming to life and dolls like just kind of freaking us out, like Chucky for instance. But the real thing actually happened in Japan, and that happened in 1918. A 17-year-old boy in Hokkaido got a doll for his 2-year-old sister Okiku. He got it from a market and he kind of realized like, oh, this looks like my sister. She even has like the same okapa haircut. And the okapa haircut is basically like a bob like style haircut with like straight hair, and then it's like cut down to the chin and bowl cut type cut, you know? So she loved the doll a lot. She felt a very close connection to that doll, and she took it everywhere with her. She was slept with it, ate with it, went out to the store with it. She just did everything with that doll. Okiku sadly died a few months later, and the family named the doll after her and prayed to it at the household shrine. In Japanese culture, when someone dies, they have a shrine dedicated to that person. And that this is not just strictly Japanese culture. Other cultures do this as well. They have a shrine dedicated to that person. They put the person's favorite foods there. They put the person's favorite objects. And they decided, let's put the doll there because Okiku really loved this doll. Long after they put the doll there, they noticed some like weird occurrences. And one of the strangest things started happening, that the doll hair started growing longer on its own. So the parents were really scared. They decided, let's cut the hair, but the hair kept growing back. And the family kind of realized like they really messed up on this like situation. I feel like we have just put a spirit into the doll, and it was just very terrifying to them, and it became very, I don't know, they just became very uncomfortable. So say that they decided, like, let's give the doll to a temple so it can get, you know, just be put there forever. So Okiku's father gave the doll to Manninji Temple in Iwamaziwa City in Hokkaido. And that doll could still be visited to this day. And there are no photos allowed, sadly. But if you look up the doll, you could still see some photos. Some people, like, sneak some photos. And scientists have actually analyzed the doll and the hair and have concluded that this is real human hair on the doll, and it belongs to a child. And that is like the freakiest thing. Like, that is just like so creepy to know that the hair on the doll is an actual little girl's hair. Like, that is just so freaky. The next thing I'm going to be talking about is the Red Room Curse. And this actually became very popular again in recent years. There's always like a big talk about online challenges that have become very deadly, like the whale one and the blue room and all of this. This one is called the Red Room.
If you're just joining us, this is Cryptic Delphic on AUP Radio, brought to you by WRP. It's 9:20.
And it's a very modern story in Japanese culture that talks about like a computer pop-up that and computers originated in the 1990s. They started to become really popular in Japan, and people say that in the time when the computer became very popular, a pop-up appears on the victim's computer screen, and this usually happens when they're alone in a room. And the pop-up has a red background with black letters asking, "Do you like the Red Room?" And the legend goes that when you see this pop-up, you won't be able to escape your room while the pop-up is popping, like it's appearing, and the doors and windows will suddenly lock, and then your body will be discovered days later, dead in your room, surrounded by walls painted red with blood. So the Red Room Curse became so popular in basically like the dark web and just all these dark places in the internet that a 12-year-old girl in Sasebo was murdered, and the last thing that the murderer looked up was the Red Room. It was in her history, and she decided, let's do this murder, and she murdered her classmate. I did further research on this murder that happened, and basically what happened was Nagasaki was murdered by her classmate, a 12-year-old girl named Satomi Mitarai, on June 1st, 2004. She basically, her Mitarai's like throat was slit, and her arms were cut as well, and she had used a utility knife. And the murderer that actually did it, they called her Suspect A, and later called her as Murderer A. They couldn't release her name to the public because she was only 11 when she did this murder, like 11, 12. And she was still a minor. And in Japanese law, you cannot release the name, and it's due for privacy and respectful reasons towards that family. She committed this murder at the Okubo Elementary School in Sasebo, and the murderer left Mitari's body and just left and went to her own classroom. And then the teacher discovered that both the girls were missing and stumbled upon a body and called the police, which was quickly identified as Mitarai. And then they did further research and investigated and realized that this classmate just committed a murder and arrested her. When police questioned the girl why she did it and why was she looking up the Red Room, she just said that she had gotten into an argument with her friend, and she just really was angry and wanted to take out her emotions, saw the Red Room, and became very inspired and was just curious as what could happen. It's very sad. And later, as this case continued and she wasn't sent to prison, she was actually sent to a psychological ward to get treatment. Her name was accidentally released in a press interview, and it really affected her and her family. Later on, as the years went by, they both gave honorary diplomas to her and to the girl who died, who her father actually accepted. And this was just done out of respect for both families. I'm going to talk about Tomino's Hell, and this is basically a cursed poem. And people say that when you read this poem, it brings death to anyone that reads it out loud. Apparently, it's okay when you read it on your own, like, but you just can't say it out loud. And if you do, it just kind of brings death or bad luck. So Saijo Yasu didn't believe in this. He was a, So it was actually written by Saijo Yasu as part of his poetry collection in 1919. And the poem is basically about a young boy named Tomino who descends into the different layers of hell. Apparently, there are 8 levels of hell, and each one is different. The top one being closer to heaven, and the lower one just being super far, and it was just like the worst of the worst sinners. Some interpret the poem about Tomino losing his soul after killing his parents, and then, you know, there's a special place for Buddhists hell for people who commit sins, and then others see it as a metaphor for Tomino going to war and then dying in agony because he's never seeing his family again, and he's never feeling the same emotions that he felt before. So in 1974, a director, Terama Shuji, he didn't really believe in this. He saw the poem, was very inspired by it, and decided, I'm going to release a movie based on this poem. And it was called Nishisu, and it's basically Pastoral to Die in the Country, in the English translation. He died prematurely at 50 due to a liver disease, but he was a very healthy man, so no one really knew why he just suddenly could like got this liver disease. And that sparked so many rumors about like, oh, he read the poem out loud, he didn't care about the curse, and that's why he died. And it just, you know, it just sparked so many rumors, and people became very afraid of to read this poem out loud. So yeah, the poem is available to be read in both Japanese and English. There's English translations. If you do decide to read it, it's called Tomino's Howl, but just don't read it out loud because, you know, the curse. We wouldn't want, no death. So I want to talk about Hanako-san, and she's basically the Japanese Bloody Mary. I remember back when I was a kid, Bloody Mary was such like a big thing. I was too scared to do it. I was too scared to actually attempt it. Just like go in front of a mirror, say it three times, and then apparently she will appear. It really freaked me out. But I really remember being told this story. I remember sitting in class one day and one of my friends actually told me about the Japanese Bloody Mary. And it made me so scared to go into bathrooms at school because I was afraid that she would be in one of the stalls. So the story goes, it's called Tore no Hanako-san, or Hanako of the Toilet. And it's a spirit that can be summoned. But you just have, you know, summoning spirits, you just either have to be brave or crazy. So the story goes is that she was apparently a victim of an air raid during World War II, and she was hiding in the bathroom stall. And then the school kind of just went up in flames. So basically how it goes is she dies in the third stall of the third bathroom floor. And then all you need to do is knock to summon her on that stall, on the third stall. You knock three times and you ask, Hanako-san imasuka, or Hanako-san, are you there? And apparently, if you do it right, she will respond, yes, I am. And then she will give you a choice of either you live or you die. I remember just like hearing about this one when I was a kid, and I was so terrified to just go to the bathroom alone. I had to ask my teacher if I could bring someone with me because, I don't know, I remember that that story quite well. So the last one I'm going to talk about is Mayuraka Castle. And this is a very real castle, and it's a very real thing that happened. So Hitobashira is a type of human sacrifice that was practiced in Japan up until the 16th century. And workers would basically wall up their live victims in pillars and just other building foundations to appease the gods. And that apparently created protection, safety for that building and for that people. So Mayuraka Castle is in Sakai in the Fukui Prefecture and is known for one of the most famous Hitobashira stories. So one of the castle walls kept crumbling down during construction, which really scared the townspeople because they were thinking, oh, our gods don't want us to be safe, we're not doing something right, we should do a sacrifice. So the workers suggested making a Hitobashira, and they contacted a woman named Oshizu, and she was selected to be the sacrifice. She agreed to be sacrificed, but only if her son would become a samurai. And so she went through with the sacrifice, and everything was successful. The wall was built, but the promise was never fulfilled. And that's why the castle, apparently the moat, flooded during the spring rains. And that happens because it's Oshizu's curse of you never like fully went through with the plan. So I'm going to curse you by making the moats flood. It's a very interesting one. Japanese horror is just very interesting overall. There's a lot of like urban legends that you can look up and just see. There's a lot of also like Japanese horror movies like The Grudge and The Ring, Japanese manga like Junji Ito. He is a huge like Japanese manga writer, and he has a lot of successful ones. Some like Uzumaki, Tomi, and The Enigma of Amigara Falls. All very interesting manga that I recommend personally. And yeah, it's like very interesting to read, and it's also been adapted into an anime series. It's called like The Stories of Junji Ito, which is also very interesting. If you don't really like reading and you're more of a visual person, you can see that, and they're very horrifying. And the Tomi one is actually one of the most famous anime horror stories of all time. It's about a girl who basically just kind of does, boys do whatever she does, like she says them to do because she's so beautiful, and then she kind of just lures them to start murdering people and just kind of do all these like horrible things. And she's a horrible person overall, but it's a very interesting manga, and it's interesting how Junji Ito's horror has influenced so many movies and other like Western horror influences as well. So yeah, thank you for tuning in today. Next week I will be discussing more horror, more conspiracy theories, more, you know, murder mysteries. Once again, everything that I mentioned on this show, please be respectful when you're doing your own research. You know, some of these stories are actually real life things. They're not made up or urban legend. And it's a very horrific thing. We're not here to glorify these murders. We're not here to glorify murderers. We're here to discuss about them and understand what happened, like discuss about the conspiracy theories revolved around them, but no means like we're glorifying these people. What they did was horrific and a crime, and our respects go out to the family and the people involved in these different cases. So yeah, I'll see you guys next week, and stay safe.
Hello and welcome to this week's climate segment. I'm Avani Gallo and I'm sitting in for Signe. With us today is Dr. Piani. He got his PhD and studied oceanography and atmospheric sciences at the University of Washington at Seattle, and he went on to work as a postdoctoral researcher on ozone and mid-atmospheric dynamics and climate change at the University of Oxford. He has a chapter in a book coming up called Climate Extremes and Their Implications for Impact Modeling in Different Sectors, published by Elsevier. How are you today? Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm fine, thank you.
Of course. So current news on climate change today, there's some stalled weather patterns that will get bigger due to climate change, and this is based on a research that came out by Rice University. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Sure. Stalled weather patterns are nothing new. Mm-hmm. In mid-latitudes, that means in places that are more or less 40 to 55 or 60 degrees north, mm-hmm. more or less where Paris is, where New York is, where London is, all the way down to Rome. Weather is associated with waves. That means winds go up north and come back down south. And most meteorologists in the field refer to these waves as Rossby waves. That's not very important, but at least you know, if you come mm-hmm. across the name, you know what this refers to. And Rossby waves have a certain speed of propagation. They move from west to east. And the speed of propagation depends on how big they are. If these Rossby waves are small, they move quicker. When they become very, very large, they tend to move slower and slower until they stall. When they stall, that's when you get what you just referred to as a stalled weather pattern. Mm. When they stall, and they stall in such a way as we are in the southerly section, which means that we find ourselves, as for example, here is Paris, that we find ourselves on the section where these winds are coming from the south, from the southwest, then they bring perturbed weather patterns. And so we have a stalled, perturbed weather pattern, and usually it's associated with disruptive phenomena. Like you can have floods, you can have, if you have rain or precipitation mm. for a week or more or 2 weeks, then you have extreme events, flooding.
So like Venice right now, is that
so? Venice is complicated.
Okay,
Venice is complicated because Venice has two things happening. It you're talking about what they call acqua alta, which is high mm-hmm. water. Yeah, mm-hmm. So high water in Venice happens because you have strong flows from the river that goes there, which is called Isonzo okay. in Italian. And when it coincides with the high tide, that water cannot exit the lagoon. Venice is a lagoon. You've mm-hmm. got rivers coming from land, and then there's a series of islands that blocks the outflow of water. So when the high tide coincides with extended periods of high discharge from the Isonzo, then you have the high water phenomenon.
Got you. Okay. So in the past, like just this past summer, especially like in Paris and Germany and these countries that you mentioned, this big heat wave, that would be an example of the stalled weather patterns, correct?
So heat waves are more complicated for other reasons as well. So you can have a stalled weather pattern that results in a heat wave, but heat waves can be caused by other things as well. Now, the reason why we worry about a stalled weather pattern and a heat wave is because when heat waves are brief, when the temperature rises, it's really not that big a deal mm-hmm. if it doesn't last too long. If you remember last summer, we had record temperatures in Paris. Yeah. The record had been the last high temperature was 40.5 degrees in Paris, and I think was 40 years old. Now, I don't remember temperature series in Paris or in other cities going back 40 years, because that would be weird. but I do know that when we hit 40 degrees in Paris, that was unprecedented for at least 40 years going back. Now, it wasn't that problematic because it lasted one day. There was a shift in the weather on that evening, and the next day the temperatures were down by 3 degrees, and the day after that down by a further 6 degrees. But if it's a stalled weather pattern and you have a heat wave, that means that you will have high temperatures, and in Paris that's just above 36 degrees, and you have that for 1 or 2 weeks. Then what happens, at least in an urban setting, is you actually heat up the buildings, and in a place without, you know, most air people don't have AC, you don't have AC in most of the city, and so you have some really, really big problems. You actually have some urban problems associated with a long-lasting heat wave. And remember, the problems with a heat wave are not just during the day. So you have temperatures of exceeding thresholds over the day. But one of the most important things that we associate with a discomfort index is, the heat stress index is if temperatures don't go below 26 at night. If the temperature stays above 26 at night, that's when we sort of trigger a stress index.
Got you.
So it's the night temperatures that are very
indicates
important. Yes.
Got you. What would you say that these countries that are going to be affected by stalled weather patterns should be doing to kind of combat these issues?
Okay. So in climate change science, we refer to two kinds of policies: mitigation and adaptation. Mitigation is what we do in general to reduce whatever driver is causing this change. In this case, reduce carbon output. And that's part of a whole body of policies, and we can talk about that. But adaptation means just finding ways to get used to it.
Gotcha.
Right? So in Paris, we've already implemented those. If we're talking about now, we're just talking about heat waves.
Yes.
So when we're talking about heat waves, what Paris has implemented is educational campaigns. Tell people what to do and how to behave. When the heat wave is coming, open all your windows at night, close them by 10 o'clock in the morning, and keep everything shut until 9 o'clock midnight. People normally think that once the sun goes down, you open your windows and let the fresh air in. During a heat wave, everything will stay very, very hot until close to midnight. So you need to keep all the windows open till 10, shut everything, drink plenty of water, drink more water than what your thirst tells you, because you will dehydrate.
So it's more behavioral.
It's behavioral.
Gotcha.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Also, if you have relatives that are vulnerable, small kids, aging people are more vulnerable because they're unaware that they're dehydrated.
Yeah.
And dehydration will take you. You'll
super
pass
fish.
Out.
I come from Texas, and it's something
So you guys know.
Yeah.
You guys know
what to do.
You're trained. But if you're untrained, it'll take you very quickly.
It's super easy.
Yeah.
That can take us into the next current issue of a current report that came in 2019, where the UN warns that the world's current fossil fuel plans will shatter Paris climate limits. Essentially, it's talking about how by 2030, the world will be compatible with the international goal of keeping global warming under 2 degrees Celsius.
You mean incompatible?
Incompatible.
Sorry. Yep. Absolutely. That doesn't surprise. I'm not aware of that piece of information specifically, but it doesn't surprise me in the least. Mm-hmm. In the least. There's, you know, I've been in this field for 30 years. Doesn't feel that way, but I've been in this field for 30 years. In the 90s, scientists made a series of forecasts of what the carbon output would be over the next 20, 30 years. And we were heavily criticized for being overly pessimistic. In fact, what has happened is that the output over the last 20 years since the 90s has been steeper than the worst case scenario. So that's where we're going. And it doesn't surprise me that we're going. I mean, some things have happened over the last decade that people don't know about. But we've, for the first 20 years since 1990, we've been getting better and better at producing clean energy as a globe. And in the last decade, we got significantly worse. And the reason is China using its coal reservoirs. Coal is the dirtiest kind. It's the dirtiest kind of energy. I use that very specific language. And the cleanliness of energy is the ratio of the amount of carbon emitted by 4 kilowatt. So if you can get more energy emitting less that makes it less carbon, that makes your energy source cleaner. So, for example, natural gas is cleaner than liquid gas, petroleum. Petroleum is cleaner than carbon. Carbon is the worst. And now China now has moved away from that. So they're going into cleaner coal and alternatives.
I did see somewhere on, I think it was The Guardian, that said that China had recently opened a new coal plant. I don't remember where it was, but just reading that is also really frustrating since
You don't need to wait for The Guardian to publish an article. China has just immensely increased their coal output over the last decade. And now they're modernizing their plants, but they're still digging out the coal reservoirs.
Yeah.
They're also going very strongly into nuclear. They've also gone very strongly into hydroelectric. You've heard certainly about the Three Gorges Dam, which environmentally, is questionable, and I'm very using mild language.
Yeah.
If you've just tuned in, this is Climate Conversation on AEP Radio, brought to you by WRP. It's 9:40.
I think that it's really unfortunate that as much as scientists have been pushing and advocating for these fossil fuel changes and just implementation that government should be doing, that governments really aren't doing it, or if they're doing it, they're doing too.
Well, but it doesn't surprise me in any way.
No.
I mean, if you the cost of fixing this environmental problem is exorbitant.
Yeah.
And the damage will be seen in the future. And political discount rates, discount rate is a measure of how important the future is to you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So if you're using a discount rate of 1%, that means that per year, that means that a dollar a year from now is worth 99 cents to you now. So, you know, governments have a very high discount rate. Whatever's going to happen 10 years from now, it doesn't matter to them because they're thinking of the next election.
Yeah.
So telling people that they're going to have a double their taxes, their carbon taxes, will guarantee them not being reelected. So it's very difficult to get these kind of low discount rates, long-term future plans, some traction, some political power behind it. It's very difficult.
Yeah.
And we all look to your generation to do this. So, and we hope that, you know, because we hope your generation won't go through the standard generational transition where when you hit the job market, certain sort of more immediate problems don't overtake these long-term, you know, let's be cheesy. Let's call them more noble problems.
Yeah. Yeah, I hope so too. I'm hoping that our generation kind of does that, because there was a lot of movements in the 70s that people were like, we need to be ecological, we need to be more peace going,
Movement is more informed than the last.
Yeah.
The will is always there, and it's a constant. New generations always have the will. But as we go forward, they're more and more informed.
That makes me very optimistic, and hopefully
by the way, if you ask me, I am optimistic. We will come out of this.
I think so too. I agree.
We've come out of other crises.
We have.
You know, we've come out of two world wars. We'll come out of this.
And I also feel that people are taking this more seriously. Like, maybe right now, like, it doesn't seem that we're taking it as seriously as we need, but I feel like we're gonna get there, based on just all the activism and just how young people are and just how old people are that are going to these protests that I've been seeing.
This fact that we're not reducing our carbon emission at this time, absolutely true. But if you look at how the language has changed in the 90s, the sort of the right wing of the world just said that climate change activists were lunatics, just crazy extremist fringe, you know, activists and doomsday. And now the language has changed completely. Now the oil companies have climate policies. No one denies climate change.
Yeah.
I know we think that they do, but they really, very few people deny climate change. What they do is that they propose solutions that are very, very favorable to them.
Yeah.
So, but the language has changed.
I am glad that ExxonMobil is now having a lawsuit against them based on all of the information and data that they covered up, which is something that I take it kind of personally as well, because I'm Ecuadorian, and they had a lot of oil that they took out from Ecuador and the Amazon, and that Ecuadorians were fighting against, and they lost just because, I mean, Exxon has so many big lawyers, but I'm glad that there's now.
But here's the thing, is that when you sue someone, you go from your source, your power source goes from government to the courts, and they are a different power source.
Yeah.
So if it works in the courts, you might have traction. So in the courts, you don't have to, you base yourself on the interpretation of a body of law by a select group of individuals. And it's, whether it's bad or good, it's different. So that's a different pathway, and you may be able to get some traction there.
That's awesome. So one final question, super quick.
Yep.
What do you believe us as individuals can do to combat a little climate issues?
So in a very simple way, the simplest things are use public transportation, walk or bike, keep your heating low in the winter, and don't use AC in the summer. And on a bigger scale, that makes a huge difference. Also, eat less red meat.
Yes.
Go vegetarian.
Veganism. Yeah? So happy about that.
But absolutely, that makes a huge difference. You don't have to be vegan. Just eat less meat.
Eat twice a week.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, vote for a government that has a strong environmental agenda,
whatever it is. Yes, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Avani Gallo, and this is Dr. Piani, and this was this week's Climate Section.
Hi, this is Jackson with another episode of A Taste of Home. I'm joined today by Sandra.
Hi.
So, Sandra, tell me a little bit about yourself.
I'm French. I'm a student at AUP, and I spent 8 years abroad before coming here.
So was it hard to be away from your country, from your home, from your like way of living?
I never really felt homesick. I adjust pretty well to where I am, but there's definitely those moments where you miss the food.
Absolutely. How did you like get your French fix?
So when I was in the US, I was in Colorado, and you have Whole Foods where you can get French stuff, but man, it's expensive.
Oh.
So to avoid paying a piece of cheese for $17 or something like that, I would go to, you know, Target or Walmart and get like Petit Écolier. I don't know if you guys know those.
Oh no, absolutely.
Cookies.
The little bit, like cookies with the chocolate with the little school kid.
Yeah.
And like the, oh, absolutely.
Yep.
I love those so much. I can go through a pack in about 20 minutes.
Yeah.
But it's such a way to kind of connect back to your childhood, but also your cultural connections. Was there a dish you were able to make?
I started as an au pair, so I was making food, and I will try to make French things like, you know, crepes and, I don't know, like hachis parmentier. I don't know if you guys know what it is. It's like ground meat, and then you have mashed potato on top.
Oh,
the
like
English
shepherd's pie.
The English people have a version of it where they put sauce and vegetables, and then, but for us is more simple.
Okay. And how is that food? What was the reception of it for
families? Oh, the kids loved trying new things, especially when it was crepes time. It was amazing. Like we did the savory one, the sweet one. Like kids were like, "Can we have crepes again?" So it was definitely not an issue for me to get my French food.
That's incredible. But your mom's Portuguese or partially Portuguese?
No, she's fully Portuguese.
Fully Portuguese.
Yeah.
What's kind of like the interesting ways that French and Portuguese food can like mix and combine?
So I grew up, my mom was a chef at the castle where I grew up. And so I always grew up eating food that maybe most kids wouldn't eat at the age, like Portuguese dish, but also I would eat paella when I was four or something like that. That's not something that usually people grow up
doing. Oh, I ate chicken nuggets as a kid. And then stopped eating them when I realized they were made from chickens. So...
No, for me, it was definitely a more, like, we'll say more elaborate food. Mm-hmm. I always grew up with that, trying multiple, you know, food from different countries. So it was interesting to bring those to the kids where I nannied for, because maybe they were not as used to. It was more simple dish. So it was interesting to bring some of those variety to them. And I also cooked Portuguese for them. It was harder because I couldn't find the fish that we use mainly. Portugal, we use bacalhau, which is a cod, but is been dried and salted and everything, so it doesn't taste the same as fresh cod. And so, but I will make it with fresh cod, which still tastes fine, but it's still not the same.
No, absolutely. It's sometimes hard to find the ingredients to really kind of bring a dish to life.
Yeah, because even if you have the ingredient, for example, like the flour is different, so all those things are going to taste a little different, but just the fact that you make crepes, it just makes it feel, you make you are up here just by the fact you are making them too. Mm-hmm. So even if it doesn't taste like home, it's still close enough to like bring the memory of home.
No, absolutely. Like going through the steps, I know when I make pumpkin pie for Thanksgiving and Christmas, I know I'm an American that does, like, America, it's a big issue.
Oh, I love it though.
I love pumpkin pie too. So whenever I make pumpkin pie, it's kind of like going through the motions and yep. like the movements and the recipes and the smell kind of brings you back. It's not just like the taste. It's also kind of,
it's comforting.
It's comforting. Exactly. And it's like the method mm-hmm. behind the madness.
Yeah, definitely. mm-hmm.
So, well, with Portuguese food mm-hmm. and French food, how can you? I know a lot of friends from back home who are Japanese American, Spanish American, Mexican, just a massive mix of culture, Korean American, and they were really able to bring together kind of like a fusion. Like I've had kimchi burgers, which. Crazy, but very good. Is there a French Portuguese kind of fusion dish that kind of brings your two cultures together?
I don't know. I have no idea. I'm guessing we do by just because we have both culture embedded in us mm-hmm. that sometimes we mix it without realizing we mix it. But awesome. Like right now, on top of my head, I wouldn't be able to tell you like. Or maybe guessing like the Portuguese dish making with cod instead of the salted one. That might be a mix. No, otherwise I really don't. Yeah, I don't know if I do that on purpose. Mm-hmm. Unconsciously, probably, but.
No, it's like it's like innate with you. Like, oh, like, yeah. This is how we do it this way. So I'm just going to like.
Yeah, let's do it that way. I don't know if that's a proper way. Maybe that's not the French way. It's just more the Portuguese way of the French dish. But yeah, maybe that's it.
No, but it's so subconscious. A lot of times it's subconscious and you kind of don't really realize what you're doing until like you. I was serving a dish. I forget exactly what it was, but I completely Americanized it. And I had a couple of French friends over and they were like, oh, this is like, I know what it is, but it's weird. I'm like, oh, I did this. And so they're like, what? Like, you're not supposed to do that. But I kind of, it's so innate in you and you kind of, you always bring your own like kind of cultural touch to a dish.
Mm-hmm. Especially when you don't follow a recipe, which usually when I cook, I don't, except mm-hmm. if it's something I've never made before or it was an American dish. I'm like, okay, let's try to make a meatloaf now. Then I will definitely need a recipe. But otherwise, you just cook from memory or from whatever, you know, you feel like on the moment. So definitely, I'm guessing that's probably where those mixed culture comes mm-hmm. into place.
And so when did you come back to France?
I came back last year in January. So it's going to be almost 2 years now.
Oh, wow.
It's too long.
is there a dish or like a scent or some sort of like taste that kind of brings you back to America?
Oh, I'm definitely happy about Thanksgiving being here. Pumpkin pie. This is definitely my favorite. I discovered that when I was living there. The grandma of the family I was working for made it for the first time. That's what I tried for the first time. I was like, oh my God. Every time she was there, I'm like, can I have more? She will make one on purpose just for me. Oh, so incredible. Sweet.
That's incredible. It's such a classic American dish that I kind of feel it really, there's such like, it's such an emotional dish too because it's always served at Thanksgiving or like when family is around. I'm a weirdo and serve it at Christmas because I just love it
oh,
so much.
Oh, yeah. Christmas too, please.
Well, it's also such a debated dish because there's so many variations upon it.
Mine is Libby's.
Oh.
The recipe in the back of Libby's, that's the one I prefer.
Oh, I'm ridiculous. I don't use sugar. I use maple syrup. I boil it. And kind of and make it like liquidy and put it into it, and so there's no sugar in it. So, but it's
I wouldn't be against trying that.
But so, is there kind of a dish that you could say that your host family was the family you worked for that you would cook and it would be like French for them? It would like.
The crepes.
Of course. I big fan. No.
Every time the kids were like, I would try multiple things, mm-hmm. but the thing they would always ask for, it was the crepes. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, crepes it is.
And thankfully, once you get the hang of them, they're super easy to make.
Oh, yeah. No, it's just, it's long to make them mm-hmm. once you have the batter, but, you know, so sometimes we'll make the savory one. I will make them on the go, so I'll prepare them and serve them. I wouldn't have time to make my own, that they will be already done with the first one and ask for a second one. I'll be like, when do I eat? Can you please at least give me 5 minutes? I eat my first one, and then I can make your second or third one.
So tell me a little bit more about your mother. Is there a kind of a dish that like for Christmas or...
Yeah,
like
we cook Portuguese for Christmas. Mm-hmm. That's always been like that. We always do at least one day Portuguese, one day French when we had people over and things like that. Mm-hmm. But now that it's just the two of us, it's Portuguese dish all or like both days. Because in France, we celebrate it on the 24th too. Mm-hmm. So we start the, you know, the big meal is on the 24th. And then sometimes you do on the 25th too. If you have, you know, two family, you need to go to both of them. But yeah, Portuguese dish, it's that fish again, the bacalhau, that's everywhere. So we have that, you boil that, you boil potatoes, you boil carrots, leeks and all that. And it's just after you eat it with some just olive oil on top and that's what we eat.
That's incredible.
And then we, the leftover, the next day you can make, you use the leftover to make another dish.
Oh, so what dish was that?
I don't know the name of it. I don't even know if there's a name, probably. But you just put everything in the pan, like kind of a wok, and you just like kind of fry everything.
Oh,
it's like not really fry, but like some sort of stir fry with the, mm-hmm. all the leftover. And I love that too.
That sounds incredible. It's such a kind of a simple dish. But also, it sounds like such an incredible flavor. Like those are all just wonderful things.
It's simple because maybe after we have like 11 dessert following. There's some sort of ritual. You have like multiple desserts. So I think it's up to 11. Maybe I'm wrong on this one. Don't remember exactly, but we have 11 different dish.
Wow.
For dessert.
That's incredible. I want to come to a French Christmas party. Tell me more about the fish. Can you say it again slowly?
It's cod, mm-hmm. basically at first, but then it goes through a process of drying it. And so you put salt, which makes it dry, and mm-hmm. then you can save it for a month. Mm-hmm. And but then what you need to do is you put it in water, you change the water often to desalt it, mm-hmm. and then you use it to make whatever. But it changes the texture of the fish, of the cod itself at first, so mm-hmm. it has a different texture and different taste.
That actually reminds me of a Japanese practice with bonito flakes, mm-hmm. and I think it's very funny because it's a way to preserve. I mean, there's salting in every culture, but
it was a way to preserve the fish at first, like when mm-hmm. there were no fridge, and you just mm-hmm. stayed like that.
No, absolutely, and it's so funny to see kind of like a similarities across cultures mm-hmm. on the opposite side of the world. And
true.
So it's I absolutely love to see the similarities, but also the differences between different cultures. Mm-hmm. So, is there another Portuguese dish that kind of like maybe like?
Oh yeah, so it's called something called churrasco. So it's chicken that is technically grilled chicken, but you mm-hmm. take the whole chicken in one piece and then you put it on the, you know, on the barbecue and things like that. But it has a taste that even if you do it, it doesn't taste the same. I don't know why. Like, you mm-hmm. know, they make it a way that it tastes different. And that's every time I go to Portugal, I just eat bacalhau and churrasco. And then sometimes I'll put some sardine in there because that's definitely a very important dish too we have. But yeah, it's just like those two things are my favorite.
And you know, Portuguese is very interesting because like it's very influenced by Spanish food, but also is very different at the same time, at least I believe.
Oh yeah, no, it's nothing alike.
I mean, like, so yeah.
I'm like, you can't see, but I'm making the eyes of the killer there.
But so like it's so crazy to see like people that are so close, but also like the
very different,
so different.
Yeah, so people say the language is similar. It's not. So mm-hmm. Portuguese people can understand Spanish people, but Spanish people can't understand mm-hmm. Portuguese people, for example. And the food is nothing based the same way, mm-hmm. which I don't know why, but yeah, it's. And also, it probably go back from when, you know, the colonial, like Portuguese, were one of the first one to travel and discover those new places and brought a lot of things back. So I don't know if that's the influence, but then the mm-hmm. Spanish were not far behind. So I don't really know why it's so different, even if it's so close, but yeah.
No, but it's wonderful. I went to Portugal once and the food was like would not stop eating. It's a real problem. Is there like another, like, does your grandmother, like, when I think back, like, each member of my family has their own kind of like dish that reminds me of them?
I don't really have a close family, so definitely every dish reminds me of my mom. Mainly. After I have my dad too, but my dad was like, you know, the chicken nuggets and the fries one, so it was definitely like, that will still remind me of my dad every time. I'm like, well, daddy's cooking tonight. But otherwise, it's mainly my mom who was cooking all the time.
And she sounds like a wonderful cook.
Yes.
Being a chef.
Oh my god, yeah. I miss it. Like, sometimes I'm like, mom, I'm coming over. Just just to get some real food who is not like 5 minutes on the pan, because I don't have time.
No, absolutely. Is there anything else that you'd like to tell us about, like, kind of like the cultural, like, heritage behind the food that you surround yourself with?
No, it's just, I think it's important when you travel to definitely go try the local food, and don't go to those typical restaurants that, you know, looks very touristy because they're always busy and people actually, like, you know, by the door and be trying to get you in. Try to find those teeny one that doesn't look much, but actually the taste is probably the best one.
Mm. That's incredible. Thank you so much for coming.
You're welcome.
It's incredible. It's so great to kind of hear the stories and emotions behind the food that surrounds us, because I think it's a very important part of kind of human culture. But thank you again for coming. This has been A Taste of Home with Jackson and Sandra.
Thank you, guys.
AUP Radio is produced by Savannah Rowe, Fiona McMurray, Elise Chauvel, and Isabel Guigui. That's me. Our theme music is by Jill Chavitz and Oliver Henry of Chateau Rouge. That's all for tonight on AUP Radio. Tune in tomorrow for more, and have a great night.